Okay, so I'd like to just talk a bit about Buddhist philosophy. And I'd just like to say that a good deal of the Buddha's teaching has to do with looking at the nature of views, and that views and philosophy may give us a wider perspective on our experience. And to look at it from that angle. So what I'd like to talk about is just how I see the teaching on dependent arising. And dependent arising, you know, sometimes it's translated as dependent co-arising or dependent origination. And what it refers to is that nothing arises in isolation, and that our experience in the world is made up of conditions, of interrelated elements, and that there isn't this sense of something being isolated, such as a self or another. And this teaching is, in this perspective, is one that we can pretty much get intellectually. I don't think it's hard for us at all to understand what that is, but to get it experientially and to really start to see it may be another story altogether. So I would say that one of the differences in my approach to this compared to, I think, many Buddhist teachers is that often you'll hear in Buddhist teachings the notion of the unconditioned, that there is something which is beyond conditions. And what I would say is that it's probably better experientially to treat that as something you put kind of like on a shelf and you wait until you get there. Otherwise, what tends to happen is you keep looking at experience as actually made up of conditions, that's conditioned, and interpret it as something beyond conditions. And this goes on quite a bit in people's practice. In a way, there can be many types of experiences that might look perfectly empty or perfectly still or transcendent or beyond space and time, but still, you're sitting there with your own mind experiencing that. So there's something else going on, which is your mind, your mental processes. You're part of the conditions. And what this also leads to is looking at our experience as really truly subjective. Instead of doing this kind of practice and thinking, well, there's something external, objective, another higher reality, to consider that what you're working with is your reality and how you construct reality and how you make meaning out of things, and instead of trying to look outside of that. So that's just my perspective, but it sets a different tone for looking at conditionality. What it then does is it enables us to look more closely at our experience, not trying to find something that's not conditioned or beyond things or transcendent, but looking at, well, how do things interact? How do my thoughts and emotions and sensations actually intermingle and produce certain behaviors and actions and intentions? How does this world that I inhabit, my body and interpersonally and with others, you know, how does it function according to conditions instead of trying to find some other answer for it, some other explanation? And this goes back to something that you can find in the Buddhist suttas, that there are, say, like four basic ways in which we may have a faulty view of conditionality. You know, and it's not our fault. It's just that as the way we are as human beings, we tend to look at things as coming about through conditions, but we tend to posit that there's a source. There's a first cause somewhere. And that first cause may be either that there's a self that has created things, so we tie back our experiences to, you know, there was a particular self or identity or persona, whatever you want to call it, that actually, you know, in a sense, created that action, that produced those thoughts, you know, or we tend to look at it as other, that was external, somebody else said it, or there's a God, or there's destiny, or something like that, and that's the cause of everything. Or we may consider it to be a combination of the two. And this is, I think, how most of the time we try to negotiate that. It's sometimes it's self, sometimes it's other, sometimes, and especially interpersonally. We'll look at it as, you know, it's what I said or did, and take responsibility or attribute causality, or it's what another person did. So that we're, you know, trying to, in a sense, look no further than there being, you know, one person here and another person there who's, you know, causing these things. And the fourth is that things come about just by chance. It's accidental, it's random. There isn't conditionality. It just sort of happens, which we all know, I think, is probably not the case. What the Buddha was saying is that, I believe what he was trying to say is that we kind of go into those default modes, and because of that, we can't really see what he meant by dependent arising. Because we keep attributing causes to a self or to another, we really don't necessarily see them as coming about through some kind of interaction, some type of contact, some type of way in which our experiences arise. So a good part of what I'm teaching here in this practice actually is a way to start to describe your experiences as you recollect them and to go into your sittings with more of a sense that there isn't a self controlling it as much. There isn't a particular word or label for each experience. There's a way in which you're kind of going in the direction, I would say, of more variation, more variety, rather than the direction of reducing down to single words or ideas. Things may seem less clear, more diffuse, you know, like before you kind of knew, you know, what you experienced was simply anger, but now you might find you're questioning it. With the descriptions that come out, you might find that, you know, it has these other flavors to it. It has maybe some contempt at times, or resentment, or jealousy, or something like that. And you start to see that because you're actually going further into discerning and describing, you're starting to get at more of a sense that it's made up of different elements. It's not just one thing. And that's seeing dependent arising, you know. And it may seem like, you know, you're just breaking down language, but you're actually looking at your experience again and saying, no, my experience doesn't fit these labels. It doesn't fit these words, or doesn't fit this identity. It doesn't fit this thing of this my particular character or habit or something like that. You might find that there's enough variation from time to time, from different instances, that you start to pick up it is coming about through conditions. It's not set in stone. It's not fixed. And if you, as you hear me talk, you see that conditionality relates to the other, you know, main characteristics or three characteristics around, you know, that our experiences are non-self, that there isn't a self when we keep looking for one, and that it is changing or impermanent, and that it is also suffering, that as we look closer at our experiences, we do find that they reveal pain. We can't necessarily say that it's going to be something that we like doing, but we are going to find that that suffering is something that becomes known as you further examine what's going on inside of you and in others. And it's not a bad thing. It just may be something that you find is, well, I can see that more clearly, where in the past I might have just ignored it. So getting back to this approach around this whole area is that when you do a meditation practice that has a particular set of instructions, you know, that you are, in a sense, doing the practice, you're bringing your attention back to the breath, or you're producing loving kindness, or a variety of things, you may find that trying to get a process going. You're using your will, your effort to get yourself to more or less naturally start to come back to the breath, and more naturally start to feel loving kindness. So the intention is actually to develop a self, a meditator self, that sets this up and that does this, and to get things going. In this kind of approach, what we're actually doing starts to be, we're not setting up a particular self to get these qualities or these types of awareness developed. We're letting it develop more naturally and then reflecting back on it and seeing how it comes to be. And to me, that's actually more in keeping with looking at dependent arising, looking at conditions, that you start to notice how awareness of breath may just come to be on its own, how feeling kindness to another person may start to arise within you, or how how you have gone through something inside of yourself around a particular behavior or intended action, and you find that you started off pretty much from a somewhat unwholesome, selfish, or desirous place, and you ended up in a more compassionate, altruistic, friendly place, and you start to see that may happen through a variety of different qualities and conditions arising rather than a self doing a particular practice to get there. So it may in a way seem random and accidental because you don't know exactly how it happened. But the thing is, you may actually get a sense that it does happen on its own a bit more. It doesn't need a self as much. Your meditation practice may not actually need a meditator, as much as you thought it did. But that's just something to see as time goes on and you continue to meditate. So I think I've said enough, so I'll just entertain any questions. And you can ask questions or talk about sittings. It doesn't have to be on the topic I just presented. Yes.
I was interested to hear what you might say or how you'd interpret teachings around a trained mind and a disciplined mind and what discipline means to you, your approach.
Okay, so the question was how I'd interpret teachings around a trained mind, a disciplined mind, and what I see discipline in this approach. There is discipline in this approach. But it's different. It's not about this kind of forceful effort that's often interpreted as discipline of just sticking with an instruction or continually doing something to produce a certain state of mind or things like that. But it does relate to restraint, the fact that in order to, really work with the thoughts and feelings coming up that are maybe troublesome or unwholesome in the Buddhist vocabulary, you need to have a ability to not act on them and to restrain yourself. And so there's quite a bit of discipline actually going on in your sittings when you're thinking of, writing somebody a nasty email and you find that you go so far, but you never send it, that you follow certain trains of thought or, fantasies or proliferation, whatever it may be called, and you are able to, kind of go with those thoughts but know that you're not actually going to follow through, that you're, in a way, you're still practicing that important restraint. Otherwise, this would be, I would really have questions about it. The other thing is that the reflecting back on your sittings, the exploring your experience, that also may require a certain amount of discipline at times. That sometimes you may feel that you can't sit with this certain feeling or memory any longer, or you're tired of looking at something. And then you realize, well, no, I really do need to see a bit more because it's coming up again, and that I can stay with it, I can go further. So there is that aspect to it. Yes. Could you give me an example?
I suppose one thing about meditation, maybe Buddhism for me, is something about finding something more to life than just...
Oh, yes.
And the approach you describe feels more like psychological self-awareness, as example in therapy. Like, I can't see this spiritual side of it.
Okay. Well, one thing that will happen doing an open meditation practice like this is your range of inner experience will expand. And some of you might have even noticed that by allowing yourself to drift, by allowing certain thoughts and things to go on, that that you may have, fall into some states or certain experiences which normally you wouldn't let yourself go into. And so part of the, the side that goes beyond just ordinary self-awareness is that you're actually cultivating, your mind to go into a variety of different states that can be developed. And what happens is when meditators report to me those kinds of experiences, then I'll talk to them about those experiences and we'll work with that kind of development. But I wouldn't kind of present it as, well, this is the reason for meditating or a goal or something like that. Yes?
I just wanted to share a little bit of my own experience with practice in case it was helpful, if that's all right. Is that all right?
I'm not sure. Oh, just a bit? Okay.
Just in relation to what you were saying.
Okay. Something you said earlier about you Right. Yes, thank you. Yes, brought up two very good points. I mean, several good points. But one thing is, you know, like I was saying earlier about trust, is certain things will develop indirectly, you know, because you're not directly trying to develop metta. But if you sit and you're kinder to yourself, you know, and kinder to your thoughts, and you're really not feeding any kind of aggression or force, you are indirectly developing metta. And so that's more of how this works. Whereas in other practices, and this is one reason why I wrote on learning meditation, we tend to, in a sense, add something to the instructions we receive. We may be getting the message of, you know, be forceful, be, you know, determined and all of that. But we also may be adding to it because of our education and you know, cultural conditioning. To, in a sense, put something more into what we're hearing in the instructions and turn it against ourselves into kind of cruelty or self-criticism. When you move away from those practices while still doing those practices, which is what I suggest, you know, that you, in a sense, be more open, allowing as you sit, but then occasionally you may go back to your old practices. You start to see in, more clearly what you added to the instructions. You know, the various things that in a sense, made it, like you said, you know, like more aggressive or fed into some kind of self-criticism. Hopefully those could get, you know, settled down. They get weeded out a bit. Yes.
Mm-hmm. The bit before that would kick in and say, you know, you must put your mind on the breath. So I get to the reflection and be like, I can't do this. I don't know what. And also during the meditation, oh God, I've got to remember what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think I must be making mistakes.
No. No, any instruction has artifacts. You know, in a way, this is not possible for me or anyone to give people an instruction that's not going to create. You know, a situation that may be, you know, create tension or interruption or insecurity or some way. Basically to acknowledge that and to consider, well, the artifact, say, of this approach is that, yes, people will, you know, try to remember what's going on during the sitting, will interrupt things that are happening so they could recall it, will rehearse what they're going to write and say to the teacher, and that's just part of what goes on. So you start to be a little bit more kind and forgiving around those elements instead of treating them as, well, they're a major problem. Usually they are artifacts. They will go away over time.
So yeah, but it just, I was just cut by the shift from, I must keep my mind here to, I must remember.
Right, that's a really good point, that you're carrying over something from a previous practice into this one. And that's what we do. That's one reason why I really don't believe you can just, you know, do a practice, stop doing it, and immediately pick up another one and find it to be, you know, say radically different. That you're carrying something, you know, through that and how you would, you know, approach a meditation practice or any kind of practice. Any other questions? Yes.
Somebody has mentioned a bit of that language is difficult to me, it's sometimes how I want it. I just wondered if you had anything to say about your metaphor and reflection and the role of metaphor and others.
The role of metaphor is that, especially if the metaphor is your own, if it comes from you out of the experience, it can be a very good way of remembering an experience and bring it to mind. But also to keep in mind that the metaphor and the experience are two separate things. It's not an analogy in a sense. It's not the same. Ways of describing your experience that you feel help bring you closer to it are useful. Ways of describing your experience that start to feel too distant and analytical in the sense of tying it to an external system, like going to your experience and then, diagnosing yourself or something like that, I don't think it's all that useful, The other thing I'd say around metaphor is that metaphor has been used in various meditation teachings as instruction. And I think that can be problematic, that if, say, someone used a metaphor, you're be with your experience like you're watching a river, you're sitting on the bank and the river is flowing by, then, what starts to happen is that people will feel that the optimal experience in that practice is just watching, your experience flow by and not getting caught up in it, and so on and so forth. And so they, I think, they use the metaphor to remind themselves to be a certain way as a form of instruction, which can turn into something harsh and critical. Even though at first it may open something up for a while. Yes?
I find it hard to remember what I actually experienced during the meditation. While meditating, I recognized that I had thoughts and emotions mm-hmm. that I wanted to recall afterwards. But when I had to do my diary, I didn't know what to write down. I didn't really remember.
Right. That's very common. And that's the thing, is that you may actually find when you come out of meditation sittings, you don't remember much. And that's really not a problem. So when I talked about journaling before, if you just remember something that is pretty clear, like you don't try to stretch your memory, just first start with something clear, then you might be able to jump to something that was a little bit less clear, and things may start to form a bit. But there are going to be states of mind you go into that are a bit like dreams. Once you wake up, it just evaporates. You can't really recall much. There's one other thing I want to say about journaling too. Because this will help if you continue to do that, is we tend to remember and write about similar things. Some people will just write about bodily sensations and sounds. Some people might just write about their emotions. Sometimes, you might just write about the thoughts that you had or certain things. So when you go back over your journal, you might recognize those patterns and to then consider, well, what am I missing? What am I not writing about? What am I not recollecting? And then you might actually hit upon some areas that are interesting, that parts of your experience you're usually not all that aware of. Because part of our tendency is to get too focused into one or two particular areas. Now, if I were teaching a smaller group, for fewer of you here, I would actually do an interview, and that would help much more, because when I work with students, basically I will hear their reports, and so a student might talk for a good 3 to 5 minutes about a sitting, and then I would ask a few questions, and when I do that, some parts of the experience that usually the person is not aware of, or something that like a subtle quality that would be maybe hard to detect at the time, may come out. But right now, since I can't do that, you know, basically you might find some of that happening in the journaling if you reread your journals.
Would it be possible to do that with one person who's really brave? So we can see it.
But then it's a bit like what, no, it'd be too much of a performance. So it would lose its actual application. Yeah, but it's different, you know. In a mindfulness practice, what you're doing is you're carrying over what you do in meditation into daily life, basically. Here, you're carrying daily life into meditation. It's a reverse. It's a different, you know, loop. So what starts to happen is that you're sitting and meditating now, and the conversation you had earlier with somebody, you know, is coming up in your sittings, and you're open to it. You're open to various things like that coming in and perhaps going through it, and then it's having some effect on what's when you see that person again or have another conversation. So what starts to happen is that you're, by allowing your life into your sittings are really starting to affect your life in a more direct way. So someone doing this may not look entirely mindful in the traditional sense, but probably be much more conscious around possible, you know, things that they would say and do, and you know how they would be in the world. That would be a real consideration, which happens with mindfulness as well. Yes, in the back. Oh, yeah, okay, I can, thank you, okay, because let me put out a couple more things about dependent arising in practice and experience, is that we're not going to see all of the causes and conditions. We're not going to be able to see all these different things. We're just going to be able to see, you know, a few. But what we see may be enough for us to understand the principle, you know. So you might not, you know, see all the causes and conditions, you know, why you got triggered by something that somebody said and reacted, you know, in a way that was kind of upset or just out of character for you. So you might not really have a real good, you know, sense of all the things related to that, but you might pick up two or three elements, and that would be enough, you know. Like you might pick up, you know, the tone of voice, you know, affected me in a certain way, you know, or I had this memory of, or I felt younger while I was with that person. Maybe that was also part of it. But you wouldn't, in a sense, come up with a whole explanation. Yes.
Mentioning dependent origination, and often one approach to that is to recognize when clinging is just at the moment when clinging begins. So it goes from contact to feeling the circle. I think you're not saying that, though, from what I can see.
Oh, yes, I'm not saying that. Thank you.
Clinging as a reference point. Is that right? That for you it's not, that there's no point worrying about that?
Yes.
And I just very noticeable, that seems quite distinct from the usual way they teach dependent
yes.
imagination. Is that right?
That's right. Okay. So I'll explain it for everyone else. Okay, no, that's good. That's good. I'm glad you brought that up. Yes, usually dependent arising is looked at as a chain, as a sequence of events. And in that sequence of events, you may be taught that if you just stay with the sense contact, that you're aware of the sound and the sense feeling of it, just being pleasant or unpleasant, that you're not going to go into, desire and clinging and so on, so that there are Vipassana techniques which are, designed for the person to just stay with that sense experience, just stay with the sound or your feeling of the sound, and try not to let your mind go any further into it, because if you start to think about it, you're going to develop desire and clinging. So that's the basic idea. The way I see it, though, is that the way the Buddha presented the chain of dependent arising was that once one part of it starts, the whole thing follows. So once you have what he's called, ignorance, once you, in a sense, are in a state of mind that's susceptible to desires arising, once you hear a sound and you see it and you notice it as pleasant, you do like it and want it, and it will just go on. So I don't see any place to actually stop that process except that ignorance. And what that means is basically that as you, that this direction is not about a kind of technique to, hold back your reactions to things, but actually to kind of accept that your reactions are how you are with these experiences, that you do react with desire and aversion, and that by reflecting back on that and examining it more, understanding its conditioned arising, it's dependent arising, it's made up of conditions, the ignorance starts to go away from that experience. They become less ignorant of it.
Sorry, when you say ignorant, do you mean you don't see those links? You don't see the...
You stop seeing it as self or other, or you stop, in a sense, making other stories about it. You really, really begin to see that, it is hard for us to see that we are, if we look closely at our interactions with people, we're going to start to pick up that people are, in a sense, acting in the way they do, and it's affecting me, and I'm acting the way I am, and that there are these interactions that are occurring, and that to try to ascribe self and others is just going to be a place to separate and say, to blame somebody or to have a position against somebody or to judge somebody, instead of seeing that you are bound in some way. And that's part of it, at least in a relational sense. Did that explain it a bit? Or? Okay. And that goes back to, if we look at, Buddhist teachings on, say, desire, on greed or hatred, sometimes that's presented as if it's just you as an individual. You see some, some food that you like, and you have desire for it. So it's kind of looked at as, well, there's an object and that you notice, and a feeling about it, and desire just comes. Well, that's one kind of desire, but it's not the one that's, I think, going to get us into a lot of trouble unless, you have addictive, tendencies or something. But the thing is that a good deal of it is between people. What is the, how is it interpersonally? How is hatred working, between two individuals or a group? And I think that's actually much more serious. So that, to look at what the Buddha was saying is that to kind of see how these different feelings and emotions are actually part of our thinking process, part of our emotional process, part of how we are with other beings. And they're not just related to an isolated individual, you know, interacting with the world. Yes? Yeah. Yes. You know, and I think that that goes with you know, the Buddha's teaching just on, you know, the first path, on someone, you know, arriving at understanding the Dharma, is that what really occurs is not a lessening of desire or hatred. It's actually a lessening of delusion. And that's what's significant, and the significant change in the person. You know, maybe some of you aren't aware of that kind of reference, but it is important in Vipassana teaching, because Vipassana teaching is, historically from Asia, Eastern traditions, is meant to help somebody. How do you say, the goal, the course of it is to enter the path, is to, in a way, really see the Dharma and then start to follow and practice the Dharma. That's the Theravadan perspective. So, you know, the nature of delusion is an understanding conditionality is a very important feature of the whole practice. It can't just be, in a sense, something that's just taking on somebody else's ideas and reading books or anything like that. It's an experiential understanding. Okay, yes.
I just want to clarify another thing, just a small thing that you mentioned much earlier about samsara, just about the word samsara. So often I find in teachings that's kind of juxtaposed with nirvana. There's samsara and nirvana. These are opposites. I hear that a lot. And yet, and then sometimes it's used to mean sort of the world out there. And then often it's used to mean endless lifetimes in this way, yeah, of tears sort of thing. But as I understand it, and maybe I've got it wrong, what you use it to mean, or what it could be used to mean, is just what's going on in here, that this is the samsara, the endless wandering is in here.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, I'm saying that, how do you put it, in a practical way, yes. You know, that's what we can know right now, and instead of, how do you say, getting caught up in some distinction of a ultimate reality and a reality that we, you know, occupy with our ordinary minds, to actually just look at, well, different states of consciousness and different kinds of experiences we have within this mind that we are, how do you say, that's operating for us. So, you know, it's hard for me to get clear on it, but what I actually was presenting in talking about dependent arising and in terms of looking at experience as conditioned is that if we shift our focus there, we're not trying to find some transcendent reality, some nirvana or unconditioned place. We're actually trying to understand this world and what keeps it going, this mind and what keeps it going.
And is that how you understand this term, samsara?
For the most part, yes. Yes. These are larger subjects. I mean, I can't give, you know, my position on it fully. You know, it's one thing I wanted to put out to the group, you know, because this is a very interesting point in the day. You know, usually I don't go this long, You know, we have an hour and a half, and there are two options for that time. One option is to sit and meditate and to have another question and answer. But I feel we've done a lot of question and answer. So the other thing is something that's maybe that's a bit different, where you would break up into groups of two and talk to each other about your sittings, you know, to actually, you know, describe some of your meditation experiences to another person, have that person listen, and then, you know, perhaps switch. And you might find that to be interesting, because an important part of this approach is actually starting to talk about your experience, to take it out of this kind of private world that we've kept a lot of our meditation in, and talk about it with another person, and to be listened to, and then to be, you know, to explore it a little bit with that person, if possible. So would that interest you, something to do? Okay, good.